Welcome to the History Nerds United podcast. I'm your head nerd, Brendan. Thank you so much for being here. Today, author Matthew J. Davenport in his book, The Longest Minute, about the great San Francisco earthquake and fire of 1906. Absolutely love this book. It was a great talking to Matthew about it. He really gets into the details. And it's a disaster book, which they're always exciting. And this one is just really interesting how many different things went wrong in San Francisco in 1906. I'm just going to shut up. Let's talk about it then. And here we are with author Matthew J. Davenport in his book, The Longest Minute, The Great San Francisco Earthquake and Fire of 1906. Matthew, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
Matthew, before we jump into this book, you are also a family man, a lawyer. Where are you finding time to write books when you're a full-time lawyer?
Well, I don't play golf. And from what I can tell from my neighbors and friends around me, that frees up quite a bit of time on nights and weekends. I've always been interested in history. And the time that I would normally be spending, or the time that I used to spend reading books in nonfiction or history, I find myself now spending that time in research on whatever project I'm completely immersed in.
Now, I will say, in case anybody in North Carolina is wondering, well, you know what? Maybe Matthew isn't going to be paying attention to my case. I did do some research. 4.9 out of 5 stars on the AVVO website. I don't know what it is, but everybody who's worked with you loves you, and I think that's important to know.
Yes, I devote all the time that I can to every single client and case on my day job, and it is very much a full day job.
All right, so we've settled that. If you're in North Carolina, you need an attorney, reach out to Matthew. In the meantime, before you need them, The Longest Minute, I really love this book. It's about something, you know, the San Francisco earthquake. I've always tried to kind of find books on it. There's not a ton on them. What made you decide to write this one?
Really, you kind of answered it with the start of your question. While it doesn't seem that there are a ton of books on it, at least there have not been in the last few decades. Around the centenary in 2006, there were a handful published, but nothing that covered the earthquake and fire, as my book makes clear, it is very much a dual event. The way that I wanted to read it myself or to approach it, I got interested in this in research for my first book, which was about a battle in World War I, and there was a reporter in that embedded with the American troops named James Hopper. And James Hopper wrote a very transportive and detailed and corroborated account of that. And a lot of the soldiers wrote home about meeting the famous James Hopper. I'd never heard of him, but they said the famous earthquake guy, the famous San Francisco earthquake guy. And that was in 1918. They were writing this. And I thought, well, 12 years before, he must have had something to do with the 1906 earthquake and fire. That's all I knew about it. I didn't know anything about it. That very summer, my wife and I happened to be going to San Francisco for our anniversary. That was 2012. And everywhere around the city, you would see a plaque or a marker or something talking about 1906. And I saw that it reshaped the entire face of the city. It bears the scars to this day. And I said, you know, I wonder what this James Hopper had to say about this. I looked up his account. It was fascinating. And I said, I'd like to know more. And I looked for books. And kind of like you said, I didn't find many. I thought, here's a disaster that nearly destroyed a major American city. In fact, it's the only time a major American city has been so fully and completely destroyed. And deaths estimated above 3,000 by deaths and casualties, the equivalent of 9/11. And I didn't know anything about it. And I said, I'd like to know more. So I got a couple of books on it. They didn't really tell me why or how these things happened. Some focused more on the geology. Some focused more on the fire. And I said, maybe I'd like to make this my next project, and maybe I'll write the book that I want to read.
And like you said, this is really a dual event. I mean, before I picked up your book, it was, yeah, there was a massive earthquake and things went wrong. But this fire is, I was about to say on par with the Great Chicago Fire, but it surpassed it, right? The earthquake was just, it was like the 1 minute or so. And then it was the fire that really did all the destruction, right?
That's right. The earthquake lasted approximately a minute, somewhere between 48 and 80 seconds, and around a minute. And the firestorm that followed lasted 3 days and three nights and destroyed all of downtown and most of the city.
Yes, because I was just reading a book Scott Berg just put out on the Great Chicago Fire just 2 weeks before I picked up your book. And, you know, the Great Chicago Fire is, it's awful. And then I read this, I'm like, Well, damn, how this one's really buried in the footnotes whenever you talk about this event. Now, there's a few reasons that you very articulately point out. One of the big problems with San Francisco around this time, right, is the difference between actual land and fill land. Can you tell me what's kind of the differences between those two things and how did it really affect what happened here with the earthquake?
Right. So San Francisco, before the gold rush and before the population explosion in 1848, 1849, 1850, the shoreline was then about six blocks west of where it is today. On the southeast side, it was further inland. If you go to San Francisco now downtown and you walk Montgomery Street and imagine that that was once the shoreline, well, what happened as the population increased, they began to build longer and longer wharves out into the shallow part of the bay there, down at Mission Cove and the bay on the east side of the city. And as gold prospectors came into the bay, many of them left their vessels, their transport boats in the bay while they went to the diggings. And many were not successful and they never returned. And so you had all of these vessels, hundreds of them, left abandoned in the shallow waters of the bay on the east side. And to solve a couple of problems, one with the abandoned vessels and transport boats out in the bay, and two, to expand for more land, usable land for people to live in, for more real estate, they began to expand the shoreline with fill. You had a lot of steep hills, it still does, but there's a lot of sandy marshlands. And as they would grade streets further west, they would pull all of this sand and marshland to the east and fill it into the bay, the shallow portion of the bay, along with these abandoned vessels. And then they would level it and they would pave over it. And slowly, block by block, it built out into the bay. So you have dozens of blocks, city blocks, that are on what's called made land or fill land. It's very weak land that when there is an earthquake, when there is motion and movement, any lateral shearing forces will cause what's called liquefaction, where it will just collapse on itself. So it's kind of like a hard shell with melted chocolate underneath, that you have all these buildings on this hard shell, and it just takes a little bit to break that shell and they sink, and it causes catastrophic sinking. And it loses its solidity when there's any movement. So much of the city, the eastern portion of the city, and all the way into other parts of neighborhoods and districts have these veins and not chasms, but regions of fill land. Underneath that, in the southeast portion of the city, is what's called Old Bay Clay. So the solid portion of the land on the southeast portion, which is now south of Market, is actually Old Bay Clay above bedrock, and it's hundreds of feet of Old Bay Clay. Then there's fill land, and then there are paved streets and buildings. Today, they have to use long friction piles, or they drive piles down to bedrock. In South of Market, they have to drive more than 250 feet to reach bedrock. Back then, they didn't do that. They would just build brick buildings or wooden buildings above the pavement, and what was beneath was invisible. It was an invisible threat, and they didn't care. Developers just kept building.
And then on top of that, you point this out too. I mean, if you're richer, you're probably going to end up on actual land that's pretty solid. So the poorer folks would end up on this kind of fill land, which means it's even cheaper construction, so that when all of this stuff has happened, it's one bad thing. But then on top of that, you're probably not going to have the top grade type of buildings on top of it either.
That's right. This was waterfront real estate, but it was also very much, I mean, this was the busiest port on the West Coast. So this was commercial. Most of this was commercial, although there wasn't anything by way of zoning in the 1850s and 60s. So residents at that time, tents and then wood shanties, were built in between commercial enterprises. And south of Market in particular, more of these wood dwellings and lodging houses and hotels with very small rooms. Let's jam as many people in as we can, proprietors would say, because you have transient laborers. And so they're all piled up, more people on fill land than there were on bedrock to the west, where there were homes and more palatial, in some cases, mansions being built out up on Knob Hill and Russian Hill and down in the more solid streets in the Mission District.
So if this isn't horrific enough, let me jump to the second really big piece of this, the Spring Valley Water Company. How do they kind of come into the story?
Ironically, being surrounded by water, it was salt water. So the biggest problem with San Francisco, this arid peninsula with not many freshwater streams or natural reservoirs or big lakes, the freshwater delivery was a big problem for an exploding population. So a resident capitalist got exclusive rights, eminent domain rights, from the legislature to form the Spring Valley Water Works, later the Spring Valley Water Company, a private company that would provide water to the people in the city and county of San Francisco at the top of this peninsula. And he and his investors, the company, did this by grabbing land down in the South Peninsula, eventually some on East Bay, but down south where there were natural reservoirs. They also dammed some streams and rivers to form reservoirs. So these storage reservoirs, then they would send it up on redwood flumes over marshy land up the peninsula 10, 12, 14 miles into the city, into distribution reservoirs that they built, and then into the city through cast iron pipes. And as it was built in the 1870s, 1880s, for the population that existed then, as the population exploded in the poor districts south of Market, the demand outpaced the pipes' capacity for even basic needs. So even delivering to a building just for freshwater living purposes, it was strained. And the fire department then would have a real problem if they needed more pressure at a hydrant for any size fire. And that is what led to the water issues. This is a private company. It's not under public control. And for many years, it used bribery and graft to preserve its monopoly and would rather spend it on that than on the overhead necessary to update its water mains through poorer districts. And there was no governing body that had any interest in enforcing that or looking out for the poorer districts to make sure that the water company that was bribing them would have to undergo the expense of increasing capacity for the populations in places like South of Market and Chinatown.
And unfortunately, the politicians just had no idea any of this was going on, right? Like this was all shocking to them, right?
That's right. Totally in the blind. This is an intersectional event. I said it's a dual event. There's actually dozens of things. You've got politics, economics, development, architecture, engineering, science, fire. But really, one of the driving forces in the cause and effect here is the politics of the time. The governing body in the city and county of San Francisco was Board of Supervisors, as it is today. But then it was 18 members. They were elected at large. So there was no member that was there as the voice of people south of Market. There was no member there who was the voice of the residences in the Mission District or North Beach. It was an at-large election for all 18. And as long as the political bosses wanted them in and supported them, that's who got in, especially 1901 to 1905 elections when Abe Roof is really running the Union Labor Party. The election before 1906 and 1905, 17 of the 18 members elected were of his party, Union Labor, as was Mayor Schmitz, winning his third term. And the one that wasn't was a fusion party, which was part Union Labor.
Now, on the other side of the coin, right, we've already talked about the way that San Francisco is just ripe for something horrible to happen. The other side of the coin is, and you make this very, very clear, San Francisco, even with all of these issues, actually has one of the best fire departments in the entire country, right? Like when it comes to that, these firefighters across the country, they're recognized as the best, right? Or at least one of the best.
They are. And that's due in no small part to Chief Dennis Sullivan, who takes over the department in the early 1890s. He's been the chief engineer of the department for about 14 years when the earthquake strikes. And he pushed and pushed and pushed the supervisors for more funding, for more horses, so he could pull their heavy steam engines up the city's steep hills. So they would strap three horses to each steam engine instead of the two in every other city. He pushed for more engine companies, ladder companies, truck companies, and chemical engines than would normally be needed for that size, because there was no what we call mutual aid immediately available. They're trapped almost on an island. You're in a peninsula where no neighboring city can get its apparatus and its firemen to you to aid quickly. They'd have to get on a ferry and ferry across, and it would take hours. And he knew that. And so he was actually with the first response at just about every fire in the city, and he would go and observe and report back to the Board of Fire Commissioners, and then in his annual report to the Board of Supervisors, the lack of pressure at hydrants in certain neighborhoods, mostly south of Market, mostly downtown, and would ask repeatedly for an auxiliary water system up on Twin Peaks, an auxiliary saltwater system for fireboats. He wanted a high draft fireboat with pumps that could aid them at the waterfront. All of these warnings were proven correct in the disaster, but he had 585 firefighters who were very well trained and very well equipped and very ready with what they had. The problem is they needed more, and he knew it, and he pushed for more, and the Board of Supervisors kept standing in his way.
Now, the earthquake happens, the fires start, and, you know, you do, I think, a great job of just kind of building that terror and, you know, explaining what happens to people in the middle of the earthquake, and then all of a sudden the terror afterwards of these fires start. What I find really interesting, I've read a lot of books that, you know, are centered on disasters, and it seems like for San Francisco, when it came to, you know, what we call command and control, they almost had the worst of both worlds, because there were people who stepped up and started making decisions, but a lot of them did it independently, which means all over the city, there's somebody in control saying, I'm doing this, but then there's somebody else over here doing something different. And you could be on one street and be told to do something else. And then on top of that, the army gets called in, right?
That's right. And you have layers of public personnel and uniformed personnel with the police department and the fire department trying to do their jobs. And then you have the military. But under the broad umbrella of the military, you have regular Army active duty soldiers brought from Fort Mason and the Presidio, and then from further away eventually. Then you have sailors with the Navy and Marines brought from Mare Island. And then you have ROTC cadets from Cal. And then you have the uniformed militia, which is their National Guard, that was brought in, some of whom who lived in the city assembled right away, and the rest brought in by the governor that first night. And no one knew who was in charge. On every city block, just about, there's a different command and control. There was no wireless communication, and communication throughout the city had been completely severed. So there's no telephone communication possible, telegraph after the first afternoon. So it became shouted orders from street to street, runners running messages, and a mayor in charge here, a army general in charge there, a National Guard general in charge over there, an acting fire chief in charge here, and a deputy acting fire chief in charge over here. And they're all doing different things.
Now, I want to transport you back there. Now, of course, you are a lawyer. I am not advocating violence, but I'm just saying, if I could transport you back there, and I could let you punch one person without getting thrown in jail, who's number one on your list during this disaster?
I would not punch anyone, but I would look least kindly at General Funston, although a close second would be Mayor Schmitz. I don't think history, a fair reading of history, ever really supports any individual being pure villain or pure hero. There's always context, and there's always positives and negatives, although in many cases, the pendulum can swing really far one way. And one of, I think, the benefits of not being from the city myself. I was not born and raised there. I've never worked there. I've never lived there. And I get reminded of that often by people who live there. But many of the people who live there have grown up hearing the stories of Funston and of Mayor Schmitz and Chief Sullivan. They know these names. And many families have strong opinions. And in some homes, Funston is revered. In other homes, Schmitz is revered. In other homes, they're villains. And I came into this with a fresh set of eyes and ears. I had no prior notion of these individuals. I knew who Funston was only because he was the senior army general at the outset of World War I and happened to pass away, so that Pershing ended up becoming our commander-in-chief of the AEF in 1917. But I didn't know his name beyond that. So I came into this fresh. I didn't know James Phelan, Eugene Schmitz, the former mayor and the mayor, or General Funston. And I arrived at everything with source material. I wanted to build this story. I dispensed with published sources and books and went right to source material in the archives and built my impressions of them based on what they did, action and inaction, decision and indecision. It led me to the conclusion that Funston and Schmitz both acted, and Funston caused more harm than good, and Schmitz probably caused more harm than good. And that's leaving out everything that led up to April 18th, 1906. You know, I remind people that Mayor Schmitz didn't ask for the military. He never called out the military, didn't have the authority to do so. That was not him. The military was sent to him by Funston. Funston decided to act and send regular army troops. When you step back into that time and put yourself in General Funston's shoes on the morning of April 18th, as he walks out of his home on Washington Street and looks down Nob Hill at downtown, and there's fires burning, and you know you have almost 2,000 soldiers in uniform, that kind of manpower just a couple of miles the other way, I think anyone would act and say, all right, you know what? I've got a lot of people who can help, and they're in uniform and they're trained, and I'm going to send them in here to help. And if you send them in there to guard federal property, which is legal, or beyond that, to help civic authorities, the fire and the police departments, in maintaining order or keeping fire lines, I think people would forgive the fact that that's not a legal order. Were it not also accompanied with, I'm going to send them in fully armed with ammunition and endorse the mayor's order of summary executions for anyone caught looting or committing any other crime. So he knew early on that Mayor Schmitz was sending his soldiers armed into city streets to be judge, jury, and executioner over any civilian they came across. And that was the most egregious action possible in the moment.
Now, you don't have to punch anybody, but I would punch Mayor Schmitz. We're not going to go into it. I just want it on record. That's my answer. I don't want to be wholly negative. And listen, this hurts me. I am a former Army officer, but I have to admit it. My favorite hero in this thing is a naval officer. Just tell me about him. I found that this guy stood up in the moment and he nailed it.
Well, I'm fourth generation Army and I served. I was enlisted, though. And so I also will find it hard to praise the Navy, especially during Army-Navy game times in December. But I have nothing but praise for Frederick Freeman. He was a lieutenant, which, as many know, is the equivalent of a captain in the Army. It's O3. He commanded a torpedo boat destroyer, and it was under repair up at Mare Island, about 25 hours north. And when the earthquake struck, they felt it. He and his executive officer and his sailors were on leave in the city. They came back in from leave right around the time of the aftershock at 8:15 while he was eating breakfast, found out through a wireless signal, because the Navy did have wireless signals then, that the city of San Francisco was in flames and fires were raging through the city, that he goes ashore and asks the admiral what he should do. The only order we know of the admiral gives him is to send a medical party ashore, assemble a medical party and send it to San Francisco to help with the wounded. And so he does that, but he goes beyond that. And out of his own initiative, for all we can tell, his own initiative, he assembles all his sailors, and every sailor he can round up at Mare Island knows his destroyer is not seaworthy because it's under repair, but goes to a sister destroyer that's also in dock there, splits his sailors, his crew up, finds a Navy yard tug and a Navy fireboat, and orders his executive officer and a midshipman to go and man those with crew, and all of them in what I would call a firefighting flotilla, then race down the bay to San Francisco. And they reach the shoreline around 10 a.m., 10:30, and see the city absolutely in flames. Everything behind the ferry building is just in flames. And he doesn't wait for any more orders. He goes ashore. He finds out where he and his fire pumps will be needed and his crew members will be needed. And he sends his vessels right down there to the docks south of Market and finds a fire battalion chief. And of course, the big problem at that point now, that would be 4 hours into the disaster. I'm sorry, five hours into the disaster. The biggest problem is lack of water, especially south of Market. So the battalion chief says, we really need your pumps and we need them down here. And the pumps on his yard tug and fireboat are much more powerful than the pumps on the steam engines. And they could pump seawater that way. So he hooks up a long line of hose and then pumps them to steam engines, steam fire engines, south of Market, and they start applying it to the flames and they save the entire waterfront. Now this goes on the whole first day and night, save the Southern Pacific Passenger Depot, save the whole shoreline waterfront, and save a bunch of buildings down from Folger's Warehouse south down there along toward Mission Cove. Later that night and the next day, spend all that time along the waterfront fighting fires as they move up to North Beach and around Fisherman's Wharf and save all that waterfront and a bunch of warehouses there. So anyone who visits the city and goes anywhere from Fisherman's Wharf down to the ferry building and down toward where the Giants play baseball, all that waterfront was saved by the initiative of one man, and it was one naval officer. It was Frederick Freeman.
And I mean, in the midst of this, and you write about this, there's all these people just doing the best they can, right? Because it's firefighters, it's police officers, it's people just on the street. Because I mean, what really stood out to me is every time you had to talk about, we talked about the lack of water, there'd be a fire and people would be running around for blocks looking for just a hydrant that worked or a well. You couldn't just have firefighters hooking up to a hydrant or something. They might be running blocks, miles, just to find somewhere where there is a little bit of water, let alone anything.
That's right. And then they'd have to hook up their engines. And one fire engine, at that time, the old steam pump fire engines trying to pump pressure from a hydrant, they could really only pump it a couple of blocks with the friction in the hose would then slow the stream, and they would need another steam pump fire engine to pump it for another block or two. But in San Francisco with the hills, that shortens that distance. So you need more fire engines in tandem from a single hydrant. There were sometimes four fire engines in a line to reach a blaze that was six blocks away just to keep water on the fire. And they saved many neighborhoods and districts that way with that kind of initiative. You know, one of the persistent myths about the fire in San Francisco 1906 is that it burned itself out after 3 days and that firemen were helpless. That is not true. I make a point of never using the word helpless in the book to describe the firemen. The firefighters were not helpless. They could well have been justified in saying they were helpless because in most places they did not have water pressure. But they adapted and improvised and overcame on just about every street where they worked. And they ended up putting out the fire. On the shoreline, of course, that's with the help of the Navy. On the west and the south ends, that's with the help of fire breaks when they finally dynamite the right way to blow fire breaks, but also with the help of a few working hydrants that they found in Hayes Valley and then down in the Mission District.
As you're doing your research, is there any one person that you sit there and you go, oh man, I would give anything to be able to interview this person? Maybe somebody that does have a lot on them, or somebody that just there's nothing really for you to research on. Somebody you could sit down and just interview them about the entire thing. And they have to tell you the truth. I'll tell you that too. In case it's a politician, I'm also going to stipulate they have to tell you the truth.
That's tough. I mean, the first name that comes to mind is Frederick Freeman. I would want to interview him about what he saw and what decisions he made, when and how and why. I would also like to interview, well, there's so many, but I'd like to interview the acting fire chief, Doherty, because I could sense the frustration that he had when he takes over the department there and he's dealing with a mayor's order to dynamite buildings with black powder and only buildings in contact with fire. And knowing as he did what Chief Sullivan's vision for the department was, I would like to interview him about his frustrations, and because he never voiced them. One of the sources I was able to find were the transcripts of insurance trials that were conducted in the months following the disaster. These are down at the National Archives, and they contain the verbatim sworn testimony of hundreds of witnesses to specific fires, how they started, how they spread. But in interviewing all these witnesses, all the way down to night watchmen and bartenders and barbers and police officers and firefighters, they interview leaders. Mayor Schmitz is interviewed in one of them. The chief engineer of the Spring Valley Water Company is interviewed, Herman Schussler. And Acting Chief Doherty is interviewed, and he gives testimony. And it's very reliable. It's sworn testimony under oath, subject to cross-examination soon after the event, some of the best testimony you can get. And so in finding those, I was really able to sense the frustration in the fire department and all the warnings that their chief had given and gone ignored.
Now, there is a little bit of, I don't want to scare anybody, there is a little bit of science in the book, especially about earthquake and tectonics and things like that, which I appreciate it. You kept it dumb enough for me that I could just follow along, right? So you didn't hurt my brain too much. But I do have to ask, when you look into stuff like that, is there any way you would live in San Francisco? Forget the real estate prices. When you read about something where you look at earthquakes and you look at where San Francisco, like, it becomes a joke that like the big one is coming and tectonics and all of that stuff. But when you really dig into it, do you be like, I wouldn't live there? What do you think?
Oh, I absolutely would. I love to go there. And when I'm there, I feel as safe as I do anywhere, because there are hundreds, thousands of emergency management professionals and first responders who have been working for decades, still work today and will work tomorrow to make sure that 1906 never happens again. Even though there will be another big one. It is inevitable. It's not if, it's when. Those two tectonic plates, the North American plate and the Pacific plate, they have been moving at the same rate since 1906 along the San Andreas Fault and along the Hayward Fault since 1868. They have been locked tight ever since. There's so much kinetic energy right there that is just waiting to overcome the force of friction and break, that another big one's coming. It could be 6, it could be 7, it could be 7.9 again, it could be stronger. But there is no place I would feel safer than in San Francisco or the Bay Area. They've gone through years and decades of seismic retrofitting and updated building safety ordinances, and they are on the cutting edge from scientists at Cal and seismologists and geophysicists to advise all the structural engineers. I talked to a geologist who gave me a walking tour of the city, and he said, at the moment, we were standing by the tallest building in San Francisco, Salesforce Tower, and he said, when the next big one hits, I would just as soon be on the 50th floor of the Salesforce Tower than on solid ground. And for him to say that, I mean, a geologist, it really meant a lot to me. So no, I absolutely would live there. Can't afford it.
Yeah, not many people can. All right, Matthew, last question for you. It's hard selling history books nowadays, right? A lot of people think history is a boring class I took in high school. Why would I read a book about it in my free time? If I can grab one of those people, sit them down in front of you, and they say, why should I give The Longest Minute a chance? What would you say?
Because a disaster of this size, a lot of people say, if you don't learn from these disasters, we're doomed to repeat them. Like the adage about history. Well, I don't like that adage about history, because only historians repeat themselves. History doesn't. But as the quote goes, attributed to Mark Twain, history can sometimes echo. There have been echoes of this. 1989 hit, and it was much like 1906, but not as strong. And because of the lessons that had been learned and because people had studied 1906, it was not a repeat of it. And that's why we study history, to understand the past, to understand what people went through. Imagine today a major American city being reduced to an apocalyptic wasteland of ashes and finding out that 3,000 or more people were killed. That happened. It happened to real people. And as reachable as the last survivor passing just 7 years ago in 2016. So it is fascinating to study. There are questions that the research in looking at an event like this will never answer. When you hear 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 people killed, it doesn't mean much. But when you think about a 15-year-old and his mother staying in a hotel because they're visiting the city and both being asleep and finding out that one of them died of asphyxiation of smoke or burned to death and the other one died from being pinned in the rubble and from being crushed to death, your mind races to 1,000 places of questions. What were their final moments like? What were the decisions? Did the child stay with his mom because he was worried she was trapped? Did she stay with him because he couldn't get out? The unanswered questions are as compelling as the answers. And that's why you look at these, because it is compelling history and it really happened to real people and it could happen again. And you want to make sure that the devastation of 1906 is never repeated. Really, the only way to do that is to make sure we understand it.
Well, Matthew, love the book. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about it.
Thank you.
And that's it for this episode. Matthew, thank you so much for coming on The Longest Minute. Go out and get it, everybody. Really good book. One of my favorites of the year. Trust me, you won't be disappointed. In the meantime, hit us up Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, leave comments, leave ratings 5 stars, please. Listen to other episodes of the podcast, and hey, send us emails. Let us know what you like, let us know what you don't like, let us know what you want more of. Love to hear from you. Till next time, nerds, stay cool.